Hi, everyone. We've started our Black Friday sale at Complete Intelligence, and you can subscribe to CI Markets for $99 for the whole year. That's 80% off our normal price of $500. Starts today, and it goes until November 28th only. Go to CompleteIntel.com/Black Friday and subscribe to CI Markets for $99. Thank you.
I don't discount it. It makes me vomit inside a little bit, but you know, I don't discount it.
I wouldn't be short stocks if Donald Trump got elected president.
Oh God, no.
The only thing that I'm concerned about is that we raised rates so quickly.
I feel like we have a date that will live in infamy on Tuesday, November 14th.
Perception is reality in this market. They don't care about revisions. They can go back. They can go back 6 months from now and say, "Oh yeah, inflation was actually 5%." Nobody's going to care at that point.
We're still going to be navigating some waterfalls in the stock market. They're just going to be a lot more shallow than anybody can imagine.
That was a criminal change. That they're using corporate profits as a metric of CPI. It's just insane.
And we're not serving 3.5 billion people in Asia because
California doesn't want oil pipelines and they want no oil and gas. Yes, correct.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Week Ahead. I'm Tony Nash, and today we're joined by Tony Greer, Tracy Shuchart, and Albert Marco. This week, a lot of interesting statements. When I contacted Tony Greer about the show, I said, "What do you want to talk about?" And he said, forwards, he said, "The stock market gone." So that's what we're going to talk about today, the stock market gone. We're also going to talk about record oil demand. We're talking about growing gas supply. And we're finally going to end with Albert talking about China, the U.S., and geopolitics coming out of that meeting in San Francisco. So, guys, thank you very much for joining us on this Friday. Tony, like I said at the top, you know, when I contacted you, you said the stock market gone. I really want to understand what that means. That was very concise. So can you walk us into, you know, what does that mean? What should we be watching right now? Why are you saying that? I've got on the screen just a snapshot of the VIX and SPX, just so that we can understand kind of what's going on in those markets as well.
So I think, you know, this week, Tone, was sort of, sorry, I just have an alarm going off for no reason. This week was a watershed week for me for observing the stock market, right? I feel like we have a date that will live in infamy on Tuesday, November 14th, right? We got CPI data. It was benign. The data wasn't off by much, but the market clearly, by virtue of its response, responded that inflation is no longer going to be an issue, right? Bonds rally, stocks rally, both are dramatically oversold, both have huge, hugely negative sentiment. And so they up and take off, right? So what I feel is that the stock market has just gone uncaged because that move broke it out above all the major moving averages that day, right? In a major magnitude S&P rally. We had a major magnitude bond rally, huge magnitude bond rallies that day across the curve. New lows in rates, new low closes in rates today, right? So all of that follow through to me means that the high in Fed funds is in. It means that we are now going to be in sort of a very tight range of Fed funds. And I feel like the market just weathered a very terrible storm. And so now the risk has changed, where the risk to the stock market was the bond market. Right. If we had hairy inflation data, the bond market was going to collapse and scare the crap out of the stock market. Stocks were going to go with it. Right. Now that has all been removed. And then crude oil went down $15 and further removed the idea that there's going to be any brand of inflation scare coming across the airwaves. So, with that all said, technically, the breakout is intact. So I don't want to take on too long. Go ahead, Tom.
No, that's great. So what people have been saying for the past year or so is higher for longer. So the part of higher is, you're saying, is gone. So it's going to remain high for a long period of time, but it's probably not going to go higher. Is that fair?
Are you talking rates or inflation?
Rates.
Rates.
Inflation.
Yeah, kind of similarly, right? Like headline inflation is gone. It's not going to be back. We're not going to see any kind of pops in CPI that's going to scare the market anymore.
Over the next 2 years or?
Yeah, I give it 6 months to a year, right? Okay. Oil price has been buried. Gasoline prices are getting buried. You know, the gas price is going to go down in an election year, come hell or high water. Mm-hmm. And I just think that is removes an unbelievably huge risk that the stock market was pricing in, right? It priced it in right into the Treasury refunding. It priced it in right into the Middle Eastern conflict. And we came out of that. And so
that all sounds good to me. That all sounds really good to me. Tracy, you know the rules here. Jump in. Don't raise your hand.
I'm trying to.
Sorry, Trace. Sorry, I keep cutting you off. I know.
What I wanted to ask is, what do you make of that health insurance print? It was negative 34% in CPI. I mean, we know they changed the metric, but, you know, that's really what brought down the CPI, right? Because it's actually included in core. So
absolutely.
What happens if we, you know, if we have a revision, say, and or is the market going to care? And the market's not going to care. It's already.
I was going to say, you know, Trace, I've matured in my thinking to the belief that the market trades off the data that it's given and takes it totally on its face.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, nobody's reading into, you know, the health insurance was something that, you know, the micromanagers of the market follow. The rest of the world, CPI 0.1, doesn't care. Stocks, bonds, gone. Right. Yep. Like, that was the statement. That's what they said. So that's what I'm going with.
And can I comment on that, Tracy? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Albert.
No, it's right. It's perception is reality in this market. They don't care about revisions. So they can go back. They can go back 6 months from now and say, "Oh yeah, inflation was actually 5%." Nobody's going to care at that point. It's done. It's over and done with. You know, these algorithms and trades, they run on the same day. I mean, if you see some decent number, that's it. It's gone for the next, you know, five business days. It's just what it is at the moment.
I've actually trademarked wait for the revision, if you guys haven't paid attention on Twitter. So, you know, I do pay attention to revisions, but I think I'm the only one. And so it's obvious that Tony doesn't care. But what it also tells me with that healthcare change, Tracy, is that the guys who publish the economic data want those numbers to come down, and they will change whatever mechanics they need to make them hit the zone that they want. So that guys who just look at the top number, they see what they want to see, right? And so that's part of the statistics game, I think. And I think Tony's right. Take it for what the top level print is. Digging down is awesome for nerds, but it takes too long for traders. Is that right, Tony? Yeah.
It's a little bit like that, right? It's like, if we're not going to trade off of the data that comes out officially, then what are we going to trade off of, right? Like, I feel like the market kind of already done and dusted, decided that a long time ago.
The only problem I see is whenever they make these ridiculous changes to weighting inflation or employment or whatever data point you want to talk about, it just, for me, it compounds the looming problem that's coming with this market, right? Because they can have clear sailing as long as geopolitical issues are in check, as long as the data that they can manipulate is in a certain range, and so on and so forth. But if something goes wrong and it gets out of their control, that's when we're going to have a problem. Do I see that in the next 6 months? Probably not. You know, so I mean, I would have to say trade on the data. What else are you going to do?
Yeah, my health insurance didn't go down 37%.
That was a criminal. That was a criminal change. That they're using corporate profits as a metric of CPI. It's just insane for me. But whatever, we can go on with that for hours. But you know, it is what it is.
So slowing inflation is a good thing. But we saw there's this little company called Walmart, and on their earnings call, their CEO said we could be facing deflation in a few months. And we also had another CEO come out in their last earnings call saying that we've already seen deflation. So I'm starting to get the sense that, you know, deflation is going to be one of those terms that we're going to hear a lot in earnings calls, you know, for the rest of this quarter and probably next quarter as a justification for shrinking profitability. So what do you see with that, Tony? Are you expecting not just inflation to kind of stop or trail off? Are you expecting outright deflation? And if that happens, how does that impact markets?
I try to stay away from economic predictions because I'm not a biologist. But I mean, if I had to trade off of what I feel like the bond curve and the bond and the yields markets are telling us, you know, I feel like the curve had a very violent double bottom down at minus 100, right? And everybody was convinced the recession was coming. And then the curve went and rifled all the way back almost to zero, 2/10, right? So now we're somewhere in the middle at minus 40 basis points, which means that we're still going to be navigating some waterfalls in the stock market. They're just going to be a lot more shallow than anybody can imagine.
That's so great.
And just related about, you know, the inflation deflation thing is like, yeah, I would imagine that the narrative becomes a little bit deflationary, which I think is just going to be more fuel for the bond market to get off the lows and, you know, kind of get rates back even another, you know, 25 basis points lower. And I think that's going to be even better for Mag 7, you know, and lower, you know, any lowering rates in the end of the curve. I mean, it's going to be good for home builders. It's going to be, you know, home construction is going to rally. Semiconductors are going to rally. Like all of the stuff is just going to start going. Breakouts are really tradable right now, and they're going to continue.
Interesting. Albert, what do you see?
Just, you know, we're at, what are we at? 4,500, 45 and change, 40, whatever it is today.
Yeah, 45 and a quarter.
Where do we go from here? I mean, what are we talking about? 4,800, 5,000 on the S&P? I mean, you're talking, I mean, I could see that at the end of the year towards the election. I for sure can see that, right? But I mean, for the next like 3 months, you know, we go to what, 45, 46, 4,800, then what? I mean, we're at all-time highs for everything across the board at that point.
Breakout city.
Yeah.
Performance chasing, career risk.
Yeah. I don't discount it. It makes me vomit inside a little bit, but you know, I don't discount it.
But yeah, Play the game, man. The thing is all these CTA chasers, right? Their models just flipped. And so they're going long because their models flipped and they don't really care what's happening in the underlying market.
Yeah, I just, you know, for me, it's like, you know, I look at this in a political script kind of way. And if they want to get the market, you know, booming by the election time, you know, I think they're going to have to fake a crisis in February, whether it be banking or something, just to be able to relaunch it back up again. You know, I just don't think that they can stay in this 46, 47 area. 4,600, 4,700 area and keep it there for 9 months.
But a couple months ago, we were talking about, you know, S&P at 3,600 or something like that. And obviously we're not there, right?
No. So they got to lose control first and they're in no way losing control of anything. There's no China. There's no Europe. So what's going to happen?
We went through the regional banking crisis. We went through inflation. We've gone through, you know, housing, worries about housing, and now everybody says 60% of people own their homes or whatever, and it's not a big deal. And so, you know, we've gone through a lot of these concerns, and you know, Powell, I think, is looking pretty smart right now. I mean, everybody wants to snipe at the guy, but he's actually looking pretty smart right now in terms of managing things and, you know, managing the markets pretty deftly. Am I wrong on that?
Just close the fucking door.
Right, exactly.
That was the best line ever.
Oh yeah, exactly. And he showed us he's a real human being, right? Which is great.
Yeah. It was cool as a cucumber for a change, right? Like a leader was like, "Are you kidding me? Close the fucking door, man."
Right. Awesome. And so, as a trader, Tony, when you see the way Powell's acted and continues to act, and is he providing kind of a consistent, confident approach that you're looking for as you look at markets?
I feel like he's a little bit volatile. I feel like sometimes he exudes pretty good confidence and I can listen to him. And other times I'm like, I feel like this guy's a deer in the headlights and has no idea what to say, you know? So he kind of gives me mixed feelings.
Okay. Do you think we'll look back on him and go, wow, he was kind of, you know, handled things as well as Greenspan, although he didn't do it as smoothly as Greenspan did, but he, you know, he handled some tough things and got things back on track.
I was going to say, it would be hard to say that Powell made too many enemies, you know, during his tenure, right? He's kind of trying to help. He's helped, as you know, helped us out of the SVBI. He kind of stewarded that fairly well.
Yep.
I thought, and you know, doing a way better job containing inflation than I ever would have thought possible. But it's just further proof that, you know, if you control the money supply and the narrative, you really control everything.
That's right.
And puking fiscal doesn't hurt either. Right.
I mean,
you know, having a DC that wants to spend a ton of money doesn't really hurt.
100%. That's going to be part of the reason why the stock market's going to go up and keep going.
Yeah.
In my opinion, you know what I mean? Like, and God forbid the economy gets back on its feet and they still don't need, then they still don't have an inflation impulse to battle. That's a really bullish cocktail for stocks.
It's tough because like they still have wage inflation hitting corporations at the moment, and they're starting to leak out jobs here and there. So I don't know, man. It's just hard for me to swallow that this economy is gonna, you know, get back on track when, you know, inflation is still 20% above 2019 levels, right? And jobs are starting to leak away from the public. So I just, you know, man, it's just so hard for me to swallow, Tony. But it's hard.
I hear you. Jobs going down is part of the volatility, right? Like we get a weak economic data, right? We get a weak print and bonds, you know, go off on another leg higher. Like to me, that could be totally part of the trade, right? Like.
Yeah. But here's what I've seen, you know, in the recession in 91, which nobody talks about anymore, we had huge job cuts, boom, like everyone fell off in about a month. Right. In 2000, same thing in tech and finance, boom, everything cut off. 2008, across the economy, everything cut off within 2-3 months. Here, we saw Meta, Amazon, Microsoft lay a bunch of people off a year ago, right? And then over the past couple of months, we've seen banks lay a bunch of people off, especially in their mortgage units and their lending units, that sort of thing. And so what I'm starting to see is clusters of layoffs, not one single economy-wide action. I'm not saying this time is different, but I am saying I'm seeing a few different things happen by sector over an extended period of time. We could still have that event where a bunch of jobs disappear within a month, but we are seeing big clumps of jobs. And we saw this a year ago in tech with a bunch of jobs just disappearing over a week or two.
The only thing that I'm concerned about is that we raised rates so quickly, like faster than almost any time in history. And so I feel like maybe markets haven't completely digested this yet. And so that's the still what if question in my.
What does that look like? Markets digesting it. What does that look like to you?
That means that I don't think it's really hit the economy yet, right? We haven't really seen labor come off. We haven't really seen those effects. Except for maybe, I guess you could call the commercial real estate market, but one could argue that was already in trouble from COVID, and that was just a carryover and just got worse with rate increases. And so I just think that I'm just still a little apprehensive or a little skeptical that maybe markets haven't completely digested this rate increase and that we could see blindsided in some respect if things really start to fall apart. I'm just saying, you know, it's just in the back of my mind. I'm not saying it will happen.
The market keeps chasing this Fed pivot and Fed cuts. You know, they're pricing cuts in like May. I think that's what they're looking at right now. Like 4 cuts for all of 2024. That's not happening if inflation, super core inflation, doesn't trend down. That's simply not happening. I don't think the market thinks that's going to, for sure, the market's not looking at that. They're not contemplating any more rate hikes. I still think we're going to get one or two in 2024.
Q1.
What's that? Yeah, I think Q1, Q2, we're going to get, you know, a rate hike, one or two of them.
So yeah. I just wanted to tell you, from my college football perspective, since we're right in the middle of the season, Tony Greer is our quarterback who just snaps back and forgets the last play and just keeps on plugging. Mm-hmm. Tracy's our offensive coordinator who has a little wider view, a little bit afraid of the defense coming after. Albert's the GM who's just kind of taking everything into view and looking for the long term. It's great. It's great.
Yeah, well, quarterbacks win championships, apparently.
That's right. Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do.
I just want to play the game right and yeah, make sure that I'm on board if there is a seasonality driven rally that to me seems like set up like a picture perfect scenario for that to take place and in magnitudes that people are not going to want to believe. And it's going to be all that much harder to jump in and get positioned for. And that's why I think it's a lasting thing.
Hey, Tony, just for reference, when you look at a position, how long do you usually take a position for? Is it a day or months or weeks or?
I start off with like a 2 day to 2 week time frame, almost with pretty much everything, Tone. That's kind of how I address it. And if I live through a 2 week time frame, then I'm usually just kind of go on cruise control, which is kind of putting in a trailing stop scenario. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, let the market take me out. And I've been in positions for, you know, in those conditions, I've been in positions for like 2 years.
Okay.
You know, you just have the trailing stop right up behind you if you get it really right.
Okay.
And great. So it doesn't happen a lot, but it happens sometimes.
Fantastic. That's really good context to understand because, you know, you're looking at things right now for a relatively near-term kind of trade turnaround, right? I think Albert's looking at things longer term, thinking elections and politics and that sort of thing. So that's really interesting. You know, not that Albert doesn't go in and out in a day at times, but I think that's really
multiple times a day.
Exactly.
What about it's speaking of the election, I mean, who knows, but Trump was good for the market, right? And if the market starts pricing him in, that's a bullish scenario that I didn't even calculate what that will do to the markets. Cause like, I don't know if that's going to be the case. So I don't think about it yet,
right?
But man, I think that would be a bullish scenario. The guy was good for the economy, good for the stock market. Right. I mean,
you would have a double positive. You'd have the Dems trying to push up the market because they want to look good for the election. And then you'd have some people in the market pricing in Trump because they think he's going to be good for the election. So
I wouldn't be short stocks if Donald Trump got elected president.
Oh, God, no. Hell no.
Right? Like, period. Not for a day.
It'd be like all in everything.
Yeah, right? Right? I mean, you know, that I'm saying that day that I'd be
like,
about,
I would like triple my energy positions right away.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Forget it. Yeah, totally. But like, you know, that on that day, the reason that day was so insane to me is because there were 17 sectors that I follow that had a two sigma or more, most of them breaking out through moving average like resistance, right? And like on any given day, like today, there's like one stock with a two sigma move on the board today. On any given day, there's probably an average of like 2.3 two sigma move stock movers. That day, 17 sectors all rallied in two sigma fashion. Like that is the everything rally. Wow. That is like if you're short, you're dead.
Yep. Wow. Interesting. Let's definitely keep an eye on that as things move. And I'm not sure, Albert, it's kind of too early to take polls at face value, right?
No, I mean, it's way too early. And you have all sorts of variables like Democratic and Republican operatives trying to show some sort of narrative and the way they ask questions in the polls. And then you have just voters flat out lying. You know, you have people right. That are pro Biden that they want to see Trump get in. So they give Trump, you know, extra votes in the polls and vice versa. It's a mess. Polling is a mess right now.
Right.
Well, it's not like, I mean, they used to call you on the phone or they call people on the phone. I mean, who has a phone anymore? Boomers? I mean, like a landline, right?
Yeah.
Seriously.
And cable. Who has a phone and cable? Okay. Okay, guys, let's move on to energy, Tracy. this week you tweeted about global oil demand at season record highs. And I want to, you know, since we have crude prices falling, I want to understand what that's about. We have, we also have Saudi Arabia saying they will continue supply cuts. So why is that? Why is crude falling when we have record demand?
Well, I think, and first that data was Jody data, so it lagged 2 months. So that was September data, just to make that clear. But really, if you look at the OPEC monthly report, which just came out last week, you know, they were, I mean, they're still showing demand very supportive, and they're, that's only, say, a month lag. But really what we have seen is a lot of length come out of this contract since October. To, you know, the latest COT report, we've seen about 40% of the length come out of that contract. Obviously, it's going to be more after this week, but we haven't really seen short positions initiated. And so for whatever reason, people are jumping out of this contract. Now, my harebrained theory is that we saw this come out, you know, as soon as markets started to rally and we saw the great, like, jump pile in into tech again. And that only exacerbated after we had that CPI print, right? And then after the CPI print, we saw oil go down even more. We saw, you know, and everybody jumping into that tech trade. And so I think that that's partially the reason, that narrative where you're changing kind of from the growth, the value to growth scenario. That makes sense, right? Because growth stocks, you know, as soon as you hear the Fed wants to pause, that pause narrative that we started hearing right before the last meeting, you know, at the very beginning of November, we started hearing a lot of this pause from all of the Fed heads, right? And so that's when we really saw a jump into growth again, because that's what those markets like to hear, right? Because you don't want higher interest rates and pile into growth. And so in my opinion, that was part of the, that is part of the exodus and in the liquidation in crude stocks. But really, it's not that anybody's getting short. It's not that the fundamentals of this market have changed. The market still remains very tight, very tight. In fact, U.S. distillate stocks, which are like diesel, heating oil, jet fuel, et cetera, are ending the fall season at their lowest seasonal level since 1982. And we haven't hit winter yet. And so, you know, we definitely have a problem with the shortage in diesel, and it's not just in the U.S. We're seeing this in Germany as well, which is unbelievable considering their manufacturing has taken a complete dive. And, you know, manufacturing definitely takes more distillate. So we're seeing this distillate problem. I think that's only going to grow as we hit into the winter seasons. And so again, what I'm saying is the market is fundamentally still tight. I know that was a lot.
It's still tight, but prices are down because investors have rotated out of energy into tech. Is that, if I understood what you're saying?
I believe so. I mean, I think it's because everybody loves to jump on that growth narrative, the Mag 7, right? It's a huge pylon. I've been posted a chart on Twitter this week. Basically, 99% of hedge funds are vested after 12% at the beginning of this year, right? And since then, you know, that kind of rotation into growth pulls a lot of out of value stocks, right? Nobody's value investing. And it's not just the energy. We can look at this across all the value sectors.
I mean, a rug pull in tech would really kill a lot of people, right? So,
if, yes. You know, if, and then,
what's that?
And then some.
Yeah.
But as long as
I'm shocked to, I'm shocked to see that number of hedge funds that highly invested in tech right now. So, but I guess it makes sense if you're talking about the rotation. I mean, we had another guest on about a month or so ago talking about the rotation out of tech, and we started to see a rotation out of tech, but it almost sounds like those guys have gone back in.
Everybody's piled in, especially after that CPI print. I mean, it's a rocket ship.
Yeah.
That's... So, and something else that you have to consider in crude oil is Cushing inventories just saw a couple of pretty big builds and kind of put them back into the range they were in over the summer rather than, you know, right off of their lows.
Still at historical lows though.
So. Yeah, no. I know, Trace. And I'm not trying to, you know, I'm just trying to circle the fact that like WTI this week was the source of the weakness, right? WTI is off 5%, gas is off like 1 or 2, and I think diesel's almost unchanged. So I'm saying it was like a purely WTI slide. It was a pure supply side issue. I mean, front month spread went from 25 cents back to 25 cents contango, and the front price front month dropped $15. You know, that was the whole thing right there, if you ask me.
You know, this ridiculous drop in this price. I mean, this is like Bitcoin style moves for the oil market. It's just super suspicious, especially with an OPEC meeting coming up, where I think they're probably going to announce deeper and longer cuts.
For sure.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. I'm long oil. Right now, I'm long oil.
You're long. Okay. Yep. Interesting. Okay, guys. And then Tracy, let's talk about gas for a minute. We saw this tweet from the EIA talking about LNG export activity from North America. Is this a realistic projection? And that's the first question. But also, why are all of the U.S. LNG facilities on the Gulf, which I would assume means they're serving Europe? Why don't we have any LNG Asia facing? Because it looks like Canada is the only one that's really serving Asia.
Well, because California, because of, you know, they're trying to phase out oil and gas. And so, you know, they don't want any more pipelines. They don't want any more. They want nothing to do with it. You know, same goes all down the West Coast, right? If you're talking Washington.
Okay, so we're not servicing 3.5 billion people.
Right.
LNG.
Because
we have the second most abundant LNG in the world or something. Well, and so, yes, or gas, sorry, in the world. And we're not serving 3.5 billion people in Asia because
California doesn't want oil pipelines and they want no oil and gas. Yes, correct. Mm-hmm. Basically, that is it. You know, they're trying to phase it out. There's nothing you can do about it. Environmental groups, there's too many problems trying to get more capacity through California. It's just not going to happen. End of story. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you know, we do have LNG going to Europe, right? We do. But right now, the other problem for that is the Panama Canal, right?
Tell us about that. What's the Panama Canal problem?
So right now there's a drought, and what they're doing is there's not as many ships can go through and not as many heavy ships can go through. So you have to split things. You know, we saw the same thing in Germany last summer with the Rhine River. We're seeing in the Panama Canal right now. I mean, people are paying I think the last figure was somebody paid $4.5 million just to jump the line to get their cargo through.
Wow.
In the Panama Canal right now. So what that is doing is it's causing prompt Asia prices to rise over European prices right now. And that's out into summer of 2024.
Okay. Wow. And so when I look at this map, the rest of the export facilities, there look to be two on the East Coast. Everything else is in the Gulf. And then we have two from Canada. And it looks like there's one from, no, there's not one in Mexico. Well, there are a couple in Mexico, it looks like.
Yeah, so, but they're not.
Is there a lot of LNG export from Canada to Asia?
No, not yet.
So it's mostly Qatar type of trade.
Yes, they're building out their export, but it's kind of a case with Canada. It's a little bit too little too late because, you know, the Liberal Party or the party in charge there was like, we want nothing to do. We don't see a base case for LNG until, you know, U.S. exports started exploding.
Who would want cheap energy? I mean, it's terrible.
That's absurd.
They do have capacity, and it's good for them that they're building out and they have more capacity coming online, so they don't have to be as dependent on the U.S. And that's for oil as well as gas. But ultimately, I mean, everything is focused and everything's been focused really on the Gulf, because we can still get it to Asia and we can get it to Europe from there. And so, you know, all the big companies, LNG, CHK, Oxy, you know, they're all building out big facilities. You know, in fact, by 2022, we became the largest LNG export facility, and we still have a little bit more in the Gulf. So we have the largest LNG export capacity in the world right now.
Right.
And we still have a couple more projects coming online out to 2027. The bulk is majorly done with, but you know, it's a huge area right now.
Right. And Texas is the energy capital of the world and becoming the tech capital of the world. So you guys can keep finance on the East Coast, but we'll take energy and tech.
Maybe if the Canadians price things in hockey sticks and maple syrup, they'd see the light. But apparently, you know, they don't understand that. Maybe. Whatever.
Okay, great. Hey, let's move on to this big China meeting that we had in San Francisco this week, where U.S. and China met. Biden and Xi Jinping met. It was kind of a
Brain wreck.
It was kind of a train wreck, but I think it's been portrayed as this amazing kind of shaking of hands and meeting of minds and all this other stuff. But I just don't, I'm not sure anything material was really decided there. But one thing that was at least lightly committed, and this is where Albert takes his victory lap, is for that China has no plans to invade Taiwan. So let's dig into that first. So, Albert, on the screen, I have an interview we did with you on February 8th of 2021, where you said, not going to happen. Taiwan invasion, not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And since then, you've been saying it's not going to happen. And there are all these fearmongers out there, so many of them saying, oh, China's going to invade Taiwan. It's that season. It's October. It's April. You know, the Straits calm, they're going to invade Taiwan now. All these boats are lining up, you know, but it hasn't happened. And so I just wish that the Taiwan fearmongers would shut up for a little while and realize the dynamics of the China-Taiwan relationship and the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. And I wish they'd listen to you. So take your victory lap, go.
Well, first of all, you had it right with the Freudian slip, but they don't have planes. They don't have planes or plans to attack Taiwan anytime in the near future. You know, it's just they don't have the military to be able to. They can bomb the hell out of Taiwan if they wanted to, but they have financial repercussions, both by closing ports down. They also have investments in Taiwan in the semiconductor industry. I mean, the CCP elite, you know, they have shadow money in those factories over there. So to make this kind of assumption that China's gonna just stroll in there and just burn everything down and take it over and install a new government and so on and so forth, it's just, you know, it's a tired argument, really. I mean, right. I've been going at this for, I don't even know, this is like 2013, and you know, I love my NATSEC guys, you know, Pentagon guys are great and all, but you know, they do have to justify budgets, you know, and their existence, right? So, but you know, until there's some sort of shift in that area where the Chinese are extremely confident that they can win quickly in Taiwan, I don't see any plausible way that it materializes. And even Xi comes over here now for this meeting, and initially it started off as him coming here as, you know, throwing an olive branch to, you know, let's work together economically and so on and so forth. But then, you know, Biden says ridiculous things. The meeting was kind of rushed, and I don't think it really had some sort of real agenda besides just, you know, shaking hands and taking pictures and pushing them out to the U.S. and global media. I mean, other than that, I don't want to see what the purpose is of this meeting at all.
California will have a glass of wine. It was kind of like
that. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, so, sure.
So I've done work for and with the Taiwanese government and the Chinese government. And when you talk to people in Taiwan, there really is not a worry about China invading. And I know that sounds kind of anti everything you hear in America panic social media, But the Taiwanese are not, you know, sitting on the edge of their seat waiting for the Chinese to invade, because they have dealt with it for so long. And the chronic continual fear mongering out of, you know, certain voices in the U.S. is just tiresome.
Yeah, it is what it is. I mean, you have these World War III type guys coming out there. Like, I mean, even Friedman was at one point said the U.S. is going to attack North Korea in 2 weeks. Things don't materialize this quickly. Right. I mean, for China to have serious intentions of invading Taiwan, there needs to be a lot of prerequisites in place economically, politically, militarily, that just don't exist right now. They just don't.
Right. So and if they materialize that quickly, if they do materialize that quickly, it's usually a mistake. Somebody's made a mistake somewhere and something's happened.
Oh, absolutely. Something's happened, or it's either desperation or a mistake's been made.
Yeah. China does not want a war with the U.S. Regardless of the rhetoric that mid-level people say, China does not want a war with the U.S. The U.S. does not want a war with China. Regardless of what people say, the U.S. does not want a war with China. And the leadership on both sides knows that.
No, so, of course not. We're in this weird symbiotic relationship. You know, China does their thing in their area of the world. The United States does everything else, everywhere else in the world at the moment. And there's no reason to change that status quo. Simply, right. there isn't any.
Okay, let's talk a little more broadly about the U.S.-China relationship. So, you know, what do you see as the key risks? And Tracy, Tony, jump in here too. What do you guys see as the key risks between the U.S. and China right now?
Oh, man. You know, that's tough. I mean, besides the whole espionage and corporate espionage and that sort of thing, I don't really see too much risk out there, because I don't really think that China can do anything that would, you know, upset the status quo of the relationship at the moment.
Okay, let me throw something out. What about supply chains out of China? I mean, China was very inept in handling supply chains through COVID. I get it, global emergency, all that stuff, but the ineptness out of China was shocking. When we had 6, 9, 12 month backlogs for things, this was just shocking. So do you think supply chains out of China are still a risk?
Not really. I don't think so. I think they've learned their lesson, and they're gonna learn an even more important lesson, where Europe is no real economy at the moment, and the emerging markets where they can dump their cheap Chinese stuff is drying up. The only place they're going to have to look to is the United States and the Middle East. Those are the only two areas.
Okay. So supply chain is off the table as a risk right now from China.
In hindsight, I feel like that was like madly, madly hyped up in order to blame inflation on it. And to kind of pair that up to be able to say, oh, look at this supply chain issue. Well, that's why prices are higher. And like, don't say anything about doubling the Fed balance sheet or anything like right. that, or spiking right. money supply. I mean, look at this canal over here is jammed right. up. And that's why prices are through the roof on everything. You know, just in hindsight, it seems like that was really, really part of the deal.
Okay.
And realistically speaking, I'm just going to say, if we're looking at sort of, say, these transition metals, battery metals, you know, China still has, you know, not only are they the largest producer of a lot of these, but they're the largest processor of a lot of these. And so they mine this stuff in Africa, they process it in China, and then they send it out. And right now, you know, we're 2 decades behind. If you want to know the truth, you know, we're talking about wanting to bring mining to Europe and to the U.S., but, you know, our permitting process is 10 years. Europe's not that far behind. We're really, you know, 10, 20 years behind China at this point. And so we're going to have to realistically rely on them, because we just can't bring the supply online domestically, either in Europe or in the United States.
We have EPA and environmental restrictions that prevent us even making basic things like active pharmaceutical ingredients. It's a dirty business. That's why the Indians and the Chinese do it. That's why we outsource it over there. And that's not going to change.
Yeah, that's APIs are, I think APIs are a huge risk for pharma and for the American healthcare system. That is a massive risk that, you know, people talk about every so often, but then we forget. And the API is a massive risk for us. What about real estate in China and the real estate markets? Could that impact the global economy, or do you think that's pretty isolated in China?
I think it's isolated and it's priced in at this point. I mean, we've already had Evergrande and other companies, you know, go belly up essentially. So what's it done? It hasn't really done anything at the moment.
Okay. And then what do you think about China's relationships in Southeast Asia? So for example, the US and Indonesia just came to an agreement this past week about trading nickel and some metals. The US and Vietnam came to a very tight security agreement last month. So do you think the US getting more directly involved in some of, say, the Southeast Asian countries is troublesome and worrying for China and could be kind of destabilizing for the status quo?
Not really. I mean, I view China's actions twofold in the Indian Ocean and, you know, South China Seas. One is security, obviously, but other one is illegal fishing. You know, they love their illegal fish. They have to. They have to pump out all that fish and feed their population growth. That's a necessity.
Right. Okay. So I think, you know, although I don't think a whole lot necessarily happens substantively in the event itself, but I think what it's allowed people to do is take a deep breath and just go, okay, let's just carry on here and, you know, try to figure out how we can have a normal relationship. Is that, I mean, if nothing else was achieved, do you think that was achieved and people will look at China a little less hyperventilatively or whatever, like a little less?
Oh, creepy? Yeah. There's no question that the U.S. and both Beijing and Washington need some sort of economic partnership or trade deal or something in the next 12 to 24 months. There's no question about that. And that's right. What I think they're probably leading up to.
Okay. Do you think that that could be part of the reason markets have calmed a little bit this week as well? Meaning, hey, this China thing is going to be okay. There's not going to be a war, you know, kind of we take a little inhale, exhale. And do you think market that could add to a little bit of, well, take a little bit of risk away from market activity?
I don't think so. I don't think that's really, I don't think you can correlate the two at the moment, only because a lot of, you know, if China starts rallying, that actually takes money out of the US and goes into Asia. So I don't really think that's much. I don't think it's a factor, to be honest with you. I think everything's what the U.S. market rallying is what Tony was talking about earlier.
Yeah. That's part of my question is the rally partly because the risks and fear of China is kind of off the table at the moment.
But you're saying, I don't think anybody was seriously considering China war as a risk for the markets, especially in the finance.
Okay. Yeah, the gold market and the treasury market were definitely not pricing in, you know, imminent conflict with China. I think that's fair to say.
And then on the energy side, Tracy, China pretty stocked up with energy. It's not like there's no war over energy or worry about energy or anything with China.
No, the demand's still high. And, you know, we even saw their teapot refineries just ask for extra export quotas for the end of the year. And so they're doing well. Their demand, despite the property implosion, which kind of leads me to believe it's kind of a controlled demolition, but that's a whole another.
Of course, topic. It is
a whole another story. But you know, we're still seeing demand very high from them, and again, we have the teapots ask for additional quotas, and so they're using it. They're, you know, selling it. Obviously, we have a diesel problem, and that's one of the reasons why they ask for export quotas, is because they can't, you know, they. The demand was higher than what they could export. So
great. Very good, guys. That's great. It's the end of a great week. I think things have ended really well. Tony, I'm really glad to hear your optimism. I think that offsets a little bit of Albert's wariness from time to time. So it's great to have you on.
It's one of those things where I can be wary and we could dip a little bit. And then Tony's, you know, thesis comes into play and you absolutely have to jump on it. My negative sentiment is something of an opportunity for, you know, Tony's
This is why we all love markets, Albert. It's a battle of ideas. It's a battle of data. And I'm not saying you guys are necessarily polar opposites all the time. I just think one day Tony wins, another day you win, another day Tracy wins. And I think that's great, right? Because it's that battle of ideas.
Yeah. Well, that's why we have a discussion, right?
So that's right.
Exactly. A lot of, and so you can pick each other's brains.
Perfect. Guys, thank you so much. Thank you. Have a great weekend. Have a great week ahead. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.
That's it for this week's episode of The Week Ahead. Please don't forget to rate us and review on whatever platform you are watching or listening to this. Thank you.